This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Jim Windolf is my guest. He's a contributing editor to the failing New York Times. He has published articles, reviews, essays, humor pieces in Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, and other places. And he's written some fiction as well. His new book is sensational. It's called Where the Music Had to Go, How Bob Dylan and the Beatles Changed Each Other and the World. Jim Windolf, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks a lot, Gary.
I really enjoyed a piece you wrote in the Times last year about Gene Hackman. You really nailed the feel.
Yeah, thanks a lot. That was, I guess I wrote that right on the day he died. Just a tribute of kind of what made him, trying to capture what made him stand apart from all the other actors of his generation. There was something just so, I don't know, salty about him or something. It was interesting just researching him, and he really had a problem with authority, and I think it came through in his acting in a good way.
I think so too. Yeah, that quintessential 70s actor, and that was a really interesting period in American cinema.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was watching old video of him on like the Tonight Show, and just see a guy with a paunch and kind of, you know, a green sweater and a brown jacket, and you know, it's just not the way movie stars comport themselves anymore.
That's right. I mean, even then, I mean, there was, you know, Al Pacino and Robert Redford and him. Yeah.
Yeah,
he was great. Well, and so thank you for writing that. What goes on? What are your responsibilities in the style section at the New York Times? What do you do there?
I edit feature stories, and just about 98% of them don't have anything to do with fashion. So that's, you know, a big part of the style's beat. But I edit the other stuff, and today I spent the day editing a story on parents who take their kids to Hooters, and we had a reporter who was spent a lot of Saturday nights at Hooters, at a Hooters in New Jersey, where there were Little League baseball teams, parents taking their kids there for their birthday parties and all this stuff. And so, you know, I guess you call them like old-fashioned human interest stories of that kind is kind of what I do each day.
Well, it says a lot about our society that you can take somebody, a kid, to Hooters. That there's such a place as Hooters, that it still exists.
Yeah.
And that you can take your kids there, and you don't have to. I don't know. What a strange world we live in.
We didn't even know it going into the story. The reporter had noticed that this was going on, and then we found out, which had been covered in other publications, that Hooters is trying to push this new family-friendly image, although the servers are still wearing the same uniforms they always wore, just about. And yet they're, you know, they're coming out of a bankruptcy, so they're trying to change something and hoping it sticks.
The International House of Hooters is going to be their next. Well, it's interesting. You know, I enjoy the style section. I get the Sunday New York Times here in California. Nice to get it.
Yeah.
Love it. So there have been, I think there are more books about the Beatles than Abraham Lincoln, or maybe they're tied. But that's like, there's a lot of books about the Beatles. And I think Dylan and Elvis Presley are like close behind. So why did you write another one? And why isn't it about Elvis Presley?
Next one about Elvis. Okay. The best count I could get, I know a really great Beatles book collector, and he has 2,100 books by the Beatles in his collection. And he says that he thinks there are 3,300 Beatles books, you know, and the count for Dylan is over 2,000. And yet there has not been this particular story, which is about their relationship, which, you know, I thought had been overlooked in the standard biographies and other books. So that's So I thought, I almost was driven to write it because I felt like there's a hole in the kind of official account, and that their relationship is deeper than even their fans might know.
Well, we're going to focus in on the last part of the subtitle of your book, How They Changed the World. I mean, I agree. I always tell people I think the Beatles changed the world, and then they say, how? And I say, well, you know, when you see your teacher wearing tennis shoes and a T-shirt, that's the Beatles. That the Beatles, particularly for someone who works in a style section, I mean, the the Beatles affected so much more than just the sound of music. That's my take. But why do you think they changed the world? And Dylan, too, how did they change the world?
Yeah, I think the same thing. I mean, you could even say when people do yoga now, they might not have gotten there without the Beatles popularizing Eastern religious practices and spirituality and things. I think about a lot of the singers and songwriters I love now, you know, like, I don't know, like PJ Harvey or Mitski or anybody. And I'm not looking to them for guidance on how to live, but I think that's the thing that was going on back then, that a lot of people, you know, mostly young people, look to the Beatles and Dylan as examples. And as a result, they kind of, you know, maybe together in some way, but they changed the cultural mores from that Eisenhower world that some people might remember, a more staid world, into a new kind of culture that, you know, really took off in the late 60s and 70s, for better or for worse, maybe you could say, but, they just, people look to them in a way that they didn't look to other entertainers. When McCartney goes on and does an interview saying that he took LSD, that, you know, he was the first Beatle to say that publicly, that had a big effect. And, when Dylan moved to the country and led this quiet life, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that communes sprang up everywhere and that so many, you know, older teenagers got on buses and ended up on the village green in Woodstock with their acoustic guitars, and that the Woodstock Festival soon followed, although Dylan didn't have anything to do with it. But they just kind of set a mode of behavior that people wanted to imitate.
My wife's cousin, the historian Ethan Shagan, refers to the tyranny of classic rock. And yeah. I think there's a lot of that in that. That is, when I was a kid, the oldies station played music from the 50s. And now the oldies station plays music from the 60s and 70s. They don't play music from, you know, 2010.
The 90s. Yeah.
So
that's right.
There's a revolution that happened when the Beatles and Dylan and everybody else arrived at that crazy decade. And there hasn't been any kind of revolution that is so overwhelming as that since then.
I think hip hop is equal, you know, cultural revolution probably, but that's spread over a wide number of different acts and, you know, media outlets and record labels. So just have it so concentrated in the 60s, and I think Dylan and the Beatles were kind of the leaders of that. It was much easier to be on every television in the country or every radio station in the country back then, before things were so fractured. So partly it's a function of how the, you know, the media set up at the time. They were inescapable, even if you didn't want to see them. So, yeah. Especially the Beatles. So things were a bit different then. And I sort of agree with your wife's cousin. You know, I was an angry, when I was 15, I was annoyed that the radio stations wouldn't stop playing Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd. And I was ready, you know, I was a Clash fan and ready to move on, but, always had this, affection and love for the Beatles and Dylan that even the new music that I liked since then didn't, break me from. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's different for those of us who grew up with it, you know, who were there for the arc of the Beatles. As you mentioned in your book, you know, you came to it from the Blue and Red albums,
which, yeah,
you were like the aftermath records, right?
Totally. Yeah. I'm like a 70s kid Beatles fan. Yeah. And Dylan fan too. Yeah.
You know, I think that simultaneously, Dylan and the Beatles demolished the profession of the songwriter as the, in the Tin Pan Alley style. I think Jolson, Crosby, Sinatra, Elvis, they never wrote songs. They just sang them. But Dylan and the Beatles both came up with the idea of writing their own songs and singing their own material, which was pretty unknown up until that time. And they did it independently, but almost simultaneously.
Yeah. And the after effect of that is to be taken seriously as an artist since then. It's way better if you're also the songwriter, not just an interpreter. There are great interpretive singers, but I think we elevate songwriters above them.
Yeah, there hasn't been since them, you know, a major rock star or singer-songwriter, certainly, who isn't a songwriter. I mean, you know, there hasn't been a you also wrote a lovely piece about Tony Bennett a couple of years ago.
Thanks for finding that. Yeah.
And, you know, there just isn't any Tony Bennett's. I mean, there are, but they play, I guess they, you could find them at that hotel, the Carlisle in New York. But, there's not a lot to do that anymore.
Yeah. That job doesn't really exist so much.
And the job of writing hit records for other people. I mean, I guess you become part of a team. I notice when you play a song by Ariana Grande, or somebody, there's a huge list of people who contributed to it. There's like 10 songwriters on a song, which I can't figure out how that happened.
Yeah, team songwriting is huge, and especially in R&B. And also in Nashville, team songwriting is still a big thing there. And there are a lot of three-person teams in Nashville. And, you know, I think even the big country stars now will write a lot of their own material, but to fill out an album or sometimes for their single, they'll turn to these pro songwriters. So I think it's a little different down there where you can make a living as just a songwriter.
We're talking to Jim Windolf, and his new book is called Where the Music Had to Go, How Bob Dylan and the Beatles Changed Each Other and the World. I think Al Jolson was the first popular singer who sang in a kind of an untrained voice, a non-opera voice, that you could understand the words of the songs and kind of gave us the popular song in that way. And Dylan is the first to sing in a really unconventional voice. I mean, I'm very used to it now, and I think it's a wonderful voice, but I think when I first heard it, and when anybody first hears it, they think, that guy's a singer?
Well, yeah, I was amazed to digging into it that, you know, when the producer for the Byrds, Jim Dickinson, I believe is his name, when he's presenting them with Mr. Tambourine Man, you know, Roger McGuinn and David Crosby can't hear past Dylan's voice at first. You know, they're just saying they couldn't hear the beauty of the song because of Dylan's voice. It was hard for a lot of people.
Well, so do you think the contribution to music that Dylan has made, I mean, certainly songwriting is a really key part of it, but his voice is also a really important contribution as well, would you say?
Yeah, I think he's a great singer. And I guess you can kind of think of it as like he democratized who can be a singer. You know, you don't have to have a beautiful voice. There might not be a Donald Fagen if there were no Bob Dylan, you know, things like that. It's more important that you are expressive than you have a huge range. Although I think his range is a bit underrated. And I always think he hits the note that he wants to hit. I don't think it's like he's singing flat. But there are singers that came after him, Leonard Cohen, or just about the same time, really, and Donald Fagen, Elvis Costello might go in that group, Joe Strummer, Lou Reed for sure.
Yeah.
Lots of singers that aren't conventionally beautiful singers that even David Byrne, they get their point across, and that's really becomes the main thing, the B-52s, you know.
Yeah, a lot of them. The more you think about it, the more voices like that you can find. I mean, even to some degree, you know, Rod Stewart or Van Morrison, they have a very
gritty but great I think now is a period where there's so many just great singers with big ranges. You know, I saw Mitski a few weeks ago, and she's just a real singer a great songwriter as well. And Billie Eilish's voice amazes me, how she can like pull back so much and go so soft and then really belt at, you know, soon after that, and her range seems really huge as well.
Even some of those little voices like Phoebe Bridgers, when she opens up and really lets it out, she's got some pipes. And Taylor Swift also can really sing. Dylan had phases of his voice. You talked about your first encounter with Dylan on record was Before the Flood, which was recorded in 1974. And his voice, he was doing something with his voice in 74 that he hadn't done before and that he hasn't done since. I don't know how to characterize it. It's kind of a spitting out of consonants. But that was the first time I saw him, was 74 tour.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I love that. I love that album. There's a couple of tracks, and the way he sings Just Like a Woman on that album is one of my favorite versions of that. I love the way he sings When He Returns, the final track on Slow Train Coming. I think that's one of the greatest vocals ever recorded by anybody.
I totally agree. That's one of my favorite Dylan songs. Yeah.
And then, you know, then there's Lovesick, where he found that other voice that's down in the depths. One of my favorite parts of your book is you had a little interview with Paul McCartney, which I want to know more about. But Paul says, I always want him to do Mr. Tambourine Man, and then he never does. Although maybe he does, because you can't tell.
Yeah.
I think it was the night that Dylan got the Grammy Lifetime thing, and he was up there performing, and we were watching, thinking, what song is he doing? And then it was, oh, it's Masters of War. But it was like 2 minutes in before we realized it was Masters.
Yeah. I love that performance, that Masters of War. It's worth people looking it up on YouTube. It's incredible. So it's kind of a car wreck, but he means it. He was also sick that night, I think, but it's a really cool performance.
A lot of people were up in arms when he did his Christian music. And I think that was partially because of the interviews he gave surrounding it. But he sure had passion for that music. Those concerts were phenomenal in terms of his, you know, he wasn't singing any of his older songs, but he had a lot of passion for the songs he was singing.
Yeah, he was completely possessed, convinced, and you could hear it in those albums. And those first, that first tour he did, he didn't play any of his old stuff. And following in the footsteps kind of his, one of his heroes, Little Richard, who often renounced his secular music and went through phases of playing only gospel. And Dylan was doing that himself in that period. And Lennon reacts to that quite strongly when he hears Gotta Serve Somebody. He writes a reply song, Serve Yourself, which I is a very rough Lennon recording because it's only a home recording that we have of it. But he started that out as a parody of Gotta Serve Somebody, but I think it's something deeper because Lennon kept working on that song for a full year and doing a different version each time he recorded it. There are 12 known recordings of it. Huh. And it becomes a pretty unhinged song that veers away from its original. If his original idea is to attack Dylan and make fun of him for becoming an evangelist Christian, it goes somewhere else. Also, Lennon had his own religious phase a year before that, which in the summer of 77, he was watching a lot of Christian television and told a few people he was born again. And he wrote two songs, religious songs, one called Amen and one called Talking to Jesus, that aren't very well known. But he forgot about that when he was got angry at Dylan for his Christian phase.
Well, your book, Jim Windolf, focuses on all of the times that they encounter each other. Were you surprised to find how many times they meet? And
I was. I mean, I knew they had, and I knew it was probably going to be more than had been generally known. But little things surprised me, like when the Beatles played Shea Stadium. I don't think Beatles fans picture that the night before they played, Dylan greeted them on their first night in New York and stayed in their hotel room with them all night, and they hung out and listened to Highway 61 Revisited, which wasn't released yet. And got high as usual, and there was some other shenanigans going on. And then after Shea Stadium, Dylan was back and at the hotel with the Beatles in Manhattan and the Supremes, you know, another party. They saw each other whenever, you know, I was just tracking their movements, and whenever Dylan is in London or whenever the Beatles are in New York or elsewhere in the U.S., they make time for each other. And it's often the very first night they arrive, there they are seeing each other.
And how were you able to track those things down?
So much of it was reported at the time in especially British music newspapers. So New Musical Express had a reporter outside the Warwick Hotel that saw Dylan go in and saw him come out. And then, Dylan's, there's a great character who's a kind of a big character in my book named Al Aronowitz. And he was a friend of both Dylan and the Beatles, a journalist who became a music manager. And he wrote some of the first cover stories for, about the Beatles in the US. And they're, I mean, some of the first really good magazine stories on them. And he'd also been assigned to write about Dylan, but he said he couldn't complete the assignment because he'd fallen in love with Dylan. He didn't mean romantically, but just, you know, he was besotted. And he was the one who kind of masterminded their first meeting in 1964 and brought them together. And people say Bob Dylan turned the Beatles on to marijuana, which was somewhat true, but really it was Al Aronowitz's idea because he thought the Beatles were going the wrong way by taking amphetamines and other pills like that. He said, you've got to try this other thing. And which Dylan had already was already experienced in that way. And so he wrote accounts of those meetings as well. And then there are other people like Robbie Robertson wrote them. You know, we have the benefit now of so many memoirs that are out there and yeah. A lot of them forgotten and out of print even that I was digging through for any little detail.
I love Testimony, the book by by Robbie Robertson. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, it is.
The Beatles, Lennon and McCartney, they had, well, and not just Lennon and McCartney, but you talk about who's the fifth Beatle in your book. And the fact is that they had this collaborative thing, you know. They had George Martin and they had their each other, and everybody contributes to that. You know, they bring in a song and create it in the studio often, whereas Dylan is a songwriter on his own. He later collaborated with other people, but most of the time he wrote on his own. And when the Beatles finally made solo records, I mean, I like a lot of their solo records. They're great, but none of them are as great as the records they made as a team. Any feelings about that? Dylan as a soloist and Beatles as a combo?
Yeah, he was a lone wolf. I think they both had something that they wanted from the other. And I think one thing that when Dylan looked at the Beatles, he saw that camaraderie and he didn't have that and wanted it. And the first time he sat down and wrote with somebody that I've been able to nail down, well, first of all, there's John Lennon, which is not that well known, but he went to Lennon's house in 1965. They wrote a song together that he recalled in a 1985 interview. He said they taped it, but it got lost.
I want to hear it. Where is it?
it might surface one day. And then, but a more serious, a more fruitful collaboration was with George Harrison, where they wrote together in near Woodstock, where Dylan was living. And before that, Dylan had just handed off lyrics to members of the band, say, like, come up with a melody for this, like with Tears of Rage or other songs. And but with Harrison, they sat with guitars and wrote together face to face. So that's, you have to be vulnerable to do that. And at the time, I guess what I was getting toward is he was becoming more collaborative. And then, you know, the way he was with the band after they got back from that tumultuous tour in 66, they were no longer just a backing group for him. He really collaborated with them. And, you know, there's a scene Robbie Robertson writes about it in Testimony, where he's critical of Dylan. He says, you know, some of your songs, you lose me, man, when you're going on and on with those verses. And, you know, and they're talked about the song People Get Ready by Curtis Mayfield and how terse it is. And Dylan's writing becomes a lot more concise after that. You know, he's taking feedback from other people and collaborating. And I think it's a warmer, kind of more convivial way of making music that he had in 67 and 68 than he had before.
Well, you pointed out in your book an obvious thing that I never thought of before, but that is that, you know, when the Beatles and Dylan met, Dylan moved toward rock and roll and the Beatles moved toward acoustic music. But now this thing that you're saying also is interesting, that, you know, John Wesley Harding or New Morning, those albums all have 3-minute songs, or Nashville Skyline, whereas yeah. The earlier albums all had 6-minute or 8-minute songs, and the Beatles never had long songs until Hey Jude.
Yep. And also Dylan rarely had a bridge before Ballad of a Thin Man. He never had a bridge before Ballad of a Thin Man. Mm. The Beatles always had a bridge. I mean, the Beatles didn't invent the bridge, but I think he had to notice that, like, oh, you know, they know what's going, you know, they know what to do. And Blonde on Blonde has, I think, 5 of the songs have bridges, and same with Nashville Skyline. John Wesley Harding stands apart. I don't even think those songs have choruses. They're just their own thing.
Yeah. This is some interesting records. You talk about the recently released Dylan's endless re-releases of the archives, and finally they released his version of Yesterday, which I love a lot. But the version that they released you can't hear George Harrison afterwards saying, "Dub some cellos on," which I love.
Is that on a bootleg?
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. I've not heard the bootleg version. That's to look that up. That's great.
I love that. Talk about the individual songs that you think demonstrate their influence on each other.
Well, one later one that I find fascinating is Dylan had "I Want You" on Blonde on Blonde, which was a pretty big hit, hit single, and also popular on the album. And then the Beatles played that song twice during their 1969 Get Back sessions in January. And a month later is when John Lennon writes a song called "I Want You." Technically, "I Want You, She's So Heavy." And I think in these back and forth, these answer songs that they write to each other, there's always an element of competition beneath the surface. So when Lennon's writing "I Want You," he's in a very minimalist phase where he's boiling his lyrics down to the bone. And I think what he's saying with that song, which has the most bare bones lyrics possible, if you're really going to write about love or lust, you wouldn't mess around with all that fancy poetry in the verses. You would just say, I want you so bad, and then "She's so heavy," and you're out. That's it. Because he was not kidding around at that point. So actually, critics at the time thought Lennon had lost something with the lyrics to that song. They're like, this is no good. But I think they're great lyrics. And I also think he was sending a message to Dylan with those lyrics, like, you know, if you were serious about, you know, this is really what it feels like to be in love or lust with somebody. It doesn't feel like the verses of Dylan's "I Want You." But there are others before that. A famous one is Dylan wrote this song "Fourth Time Around" on Blonde on Blonde. And it takes the same melody from "Norwegian Wood" on the Beatles' Rubber Soul album. And Dylan wrote it again as like a message to the Beatles, kind of a warning, because he thought they'd been in his musical territory a bit too much. And he called it "Fourth Time Around," I believe, because it was, in his view, the fourth time the Beatles had gone into his territory or too close to Dylan's style. and Lennon was kind of aghast when he heard it. So that's interesting that they had a few more of those as well.
Is that your speculation, or do you have some, can you back that up?
It's part speculation, but it's not speculation that it was a rewrite. Because even the night he unveiled it, Al Kooper, who was in his band, said, "What are you doing? This sounds so much like Norwegian Wood." And Dylan says, "I'm afraid they stole it from me," meaning they stole from my style, "and I've got to take it back." So I think that's enough there. And also the fact that both songs have the same subject matter. They're both about a romantic night gone awry in different ways. And the ending of that song, Dylan breaks away from the main narrative. "I never asked for your crutch, so don't ask for mine," which Lennon interpreted as, "Is he talking to me? You know, is this a message?" You know, and I think he was. So I think it's a little more than speculation. And it's funny, when he went on tour in 66, the first half of the show was acoustic, and Blonde on Blonde was not yet in stores. There, I found two different examples of British critics listening to during that tour, writing their reviews. "Did Dylan play Norwegian Wood?" You know, they thought it was Norwegian Wood.
Interesting. Well, we know that John Lennon is really competitive, because he says so in his interviews. There's a lot of places where he says, you know, he wants everybody to fail and he wants to be the only one.
Yeah.
I don't think Mark Cartney might be just as competitive, but he doesn't pronounce it in the same way. But what about Dylan? Is Dylan openly competitive?
I think he is competitive. I'm trying to think how openly competitive he is. But, you know, I think he sees a very small number of peers out there in the world. And I think he saw the Beatles as one. And he did, I can't think of too many more. He Curtis Mayfield and Smokey Robinson were two songwriters that he looked up to that were around his age. But I can't think of him making pronouncements about, you know, he was often kind of humble. Like he said, when he made John Wesley Harding, he said, you know, I was trying to make one of those nice Gordon Lightfoot albums. They're so beautiful to listen to. And I couldn't get there, you know, so it's kind of funny.
On his Theme Time Radio Hour once, he was talking about these two, I can't remember who the artists were, but these two ska or reggae artists who, you know, they were so competitive that they had a shootout on the street. And then he says, a similar thing once happened between me and Gordon Lightfoot.
That's funny. So have you seen that scene there's in that, you know, that Rolling Thunder documentary that Scorsese made? And there's a scene with Dylan, Gordon Lightfoot, and Joni Mitchell. I think it's at Gordon Lightfoot's house. And Joni Mitchell unveils Coyote, and Gordon Lightfoot and Dylan are watching her play. For one thing, she has her own tunings. They cannot figure out what she's doing on the guitar. And in a way, I think they're both thinking, like, I can't top that. You know, I think that's another time where Dylan's looking at somebody like, oh, damn, you know, that's she's doing something I can't do. But it's rare.
Yeah. And so he invites her to join the tour, right?
Yeah.
That reminds me of Rinaldo and Clara, which is a movie I really love, even though you can't see it anymore. But I saw it at the theater when it came out, the original version of it. And I loved it. I would love to see it again. I don't know why they don't make it available. But
sorry, but did you see it in New York at was it showed at the Whitney or something like that? Do you remember where you saw it?
I do remember. I saw it in Santa Cruz at a theater here called the Sashmouth Cinema. And they had
cool.
Beautiful stereo sound set up, and it was a great night. I loved it. That was a wonderful movie. You know, because Dylan tells a lot of stories in the movie. Sometimes the stories are songs, and sometimes they're scenes acted out. It was later recut, or maybe a year later they put a shorter version out, which wasn't nearly as good. The long version was the way to go.
Yeah. It's funny, the reviews were not really so bad, but, you know, Pauline Kael wrote such a killer review, and I almost think that review killed that movie. And I like her as a critic, but yeah.
Well, she doesn't like Citizen Kane either.
Yeah.
The Dylan made movies, some of them terrible, but I can't even remember the name of one that he made in the 80s where he was acting in it.
Yeah, Hearts of Fire.
Yeah, it's awful. But the Beatles made Hard Day's Night, and Hard Day's Night, it's not just that it was entertaining in 1964 when it came out, but it is really great. I mean, it is still a really great classic film. I love it.
It's great. Yeah. Dylan, I think he weirdly did this parody of A Hard Day's Night. He has this time in the 66 tour when he's in Liverpool, and he has himself filmed outside this warehouse where the Beatles had done a photo shoot in 1962. And there's the full footage of this because he has a still camera man, and he also has a film crew, which was D.A. Pennebaker's film crew, actually Howard Alk and his wife Jones Alk on sound. And Dylan films the photo shoot, and he also films himself like running across a lot, which I think is really calls to mind the hilarious running that the Beatles did, the energetic, you know, zany stuff from A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. That footage is at the Dylan archive in Tulsa, and that's not widely seen. And it was really kind of fascinating to me that he was going into their territory to make that part of a documentary he was working on, that Eat the Document. I don't know if you saw that one, but that one also barely came out.
It's hard to watch that one.
I mean, yeah.
It's hard to watch because there's a lot of quick cutting and moving of the camera around.
That's right. But there could be, given what I saw, this Liverpool footage and other stuff, the footage is great. I think it's the editing, the chopping it up that made it, that makes it hard to watch. So.
Yeah, well, I want to see it. I want to see it. But I wonder if Dylan was ever tempted to, you know, I mean, Presley made 31 movies. The Beatles made two.
Yep. They made After Help Magical Mystery Tour. Don't forget.
TV.
And actually, weirdly, Magical Mystery Tour, I think, holds up a little better than Help nowadays, although Magical Mystery Tour was really slagged at the time, but it's an enjoyable hour, you know, to watch now. It's so crazy. Cause really there are five songs in it. So the rest, who cares? And,
great song,
it's very cool that nowadays it's cool to just see, you know, 1960s, you know, England and the Beatles kind of just interacting with people, and it's pretty insane to watch. Whereas Help has not held up very well. But the musical sequences are good in Help.
Oh, they're great. I mean, it has an unfortunate racial issues, I guess, today. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which nobody thought about then.
Yeah.
I love it. I love Help, though. But I do I love Magical Mystery Tour also, but I never saw it then. I didn't see it until, you know, the mid 70s when it finally started to show up in, you know, Beatles Fest stuff, but we didn't see it at the time. I didn't quite get it because I had the record and I loved it, but I said, wait a minute, there's a movie? Where is it? I was just a kid. I didn't have access to Melody Maker, so I didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah.
And television also interesting. The Beatles, not only are they on the Ed Sullivan Show, which was important for them and getting them, you know, the way they crashed the world with the in February of 64 when they were on Ed Sullivan, but they were on TV all the time. They were on Shindig and Hullabaloo and the Smothers Brothers, and Dylan was never on TV. He was on this Johnny Cash show.
Yeah, he was on Steve Allen in 64. Steve Allen does this really weirdly fawning interview where he's just slathering on the phrase so thick that Dylan seems really uncomfortable. and Dylan walked off the set of the Ed Sullivan Show a year before the Beatles were on it over a dispute. He wanted to play this Talking John Birch Paranoid Blues, and the CBS network people told him no, and he walked out. he's had an uneasy relationship with television his whole career. And even when he goes on now, I've heard he makes a demand that they keep the camera still. And even in live concerts, you know, nowadays, if he's at a festival show where other groups are having cameras on them, like, he wants his camera to just be still, and he doesn't want this moving around and all that stuff that most acts have nowadays.
The last time I saw him in concert, which was recently, he was sitting at a piano the entire time, and he had two bottles of water on top of the piano that obscured his face from almost any place in the auditorium. There was a woman sitting next to me that said, does anybody have a softball? You know, because she was thinking hurling it at the bottles. It's pretty hit and miss when you see him in concert now. And you talk about this a little bit. You say that on the record, he's really able to sing in a very clear way. I mean, his voice is still that gravelly, low-down voice that he's had for a while. But it does sound a lot better on record than he can do live. And I always wonder, why does he perform live?
I've weirdly had a few nights, even in the last few years, where he's had that voice on stage. I've seen him on nights where he hasn't gotten there at all. But where the voice is as good as it is on like those so-called Sinatra albums, and I think on Rough and Rowdy Ways he's sounding good too.
Yeah.
And I've heard that voice in concert, and it's great to when you're there for one of those nights. So he can do it. I mean, it's not his 1965 or even his 1985 or I'd say 78 voice or something like that, but it's a really great voice still. But you can get there on a night where he doesn't have it. And he's had phases that go for a full year, like in the Dylan forums, they call it like, you know, 2012. Oh, that was the year he was singing like Wolfman Jack for the whole concert tour. You know? and then he'll ease up and his voice gets, easier and, more pleasant to listen to. So.
Well, I mean, they're both, he and Paul McCartney are both in their 80s. McCartney was on Saturday Night Live recently, and you can hear now that, for the first time, really, in his life, McCartney's voice is not the strong voice that it's always been. I mean, it still sounds great, but it doesn't sound as good as it sounded, you know, 8 or 10 years ago, for sure. But he still puts on quite a show for like 3 hours doing, and he's a real, you know, he's a real people person, speaks to the audience. I think I've heard Dylan talk to the audience, and I've seen Dylan hundreds of times. I've seen him talk to the audience, I don't know, maybe 5 times. He doesn't say much.
Yeah, it's rare. Yeah. They have very different approaches to their shows. I mean, McCartney has, in a way, they're respectful of their audience in different ways, and that McCartney, he would feel guilty if someone came to a show. I think he said this on a recent podcast that, you know, if somebody showed up and he didn't play the hits, they would feel ripped off, and he doesn't want to be responsible for that. Dylan, on the other hand, feels like if I'm just on stage going through the motions, that would rip off my audience. So I've got to do something that works for me. And if they come along for the ride, great. And if they don't, too bad. I think he tried to shake the gawkers from his crowd in the late 80s when he started what's called now called the Never Ending Tour. And that was about, you know, instead of people coming to see the legend, he just wanted them to come see the man who was actually writing these songs and singing them the best he could on a given night. And that's what you got. And I saw some very rough shows in the early 90s. And then there's some show I saw in a gymnasium at a small college in 1994 in New Jersey. And it was just like so delightful, you know, out of nowhere. And I was like, whoa. And now I understood. I'm like, he's still serious and he still means it. And it was, every song was beautiful. And it was I was kind of blown away. I mean, I liked the other shows I'd seen before that, but that made me realize, oh, he's not kidding around. And he wasn't, you know, if he had off nights before, it wasn't out of lack of meaning it. It's just something else was going on. And I've seen, you know, a lot of good nights since then as well.
Well, we're talking with Jim Windolf, and his new book is called Where the Music Had to Go, How Bob Dylan and the Beatles Changed Each Other and the World. I love this book. It's an amazing book. I've seen Dylan, you know, many, many times over the years, sometimes fantastic, phenomenal, sometimes horrible. Once, you know, I was like right at the lip of the stage. There was nobody closer to him than me in the auditorium, and yet it was terrible. And other times, you know, he's just been fantastic and just transcends. It's a very iffy and strange thing. But his records, I mean, both these guys are in their 80s. When Sinatra was in as old as these two, he was done already. And when I think I saw Sinatra when he was, I saw him when he was in his 60s, saw him in his 70s, still great. But toward the end, he was lost, didn't know where he was. He had these big teleprompters with these giant words on them. He'd get thrown. He'd tell the same story twice. And I would think, well, he shouldn't be out there. You know, he should stop. But every once in a while in those late Sinatra concerts, he'd hit a thing. He'd just do a Sinatra thing. And everybody in the room would go, oh, you know. And so I think, well, these people have never seen him, maybe. And now they can say they saw him. So I think that might be true for people who go see Dylan now. They're not seeing the shows we saw in the 70s, but they're seeing a legendary performer.
Yeah. And he's not trying to play the old hits. So you're going to see, you know, these days, 60% to 80% of the songs are going to be written since 2000 anyway, and a lot of them from the last album. So he's not competing. He's not trying to compete with his old self, really. So it's a different thing. I saw Bruce Springsteen a couple weeks ago. I was amazed at how his voice has held up. I mean, geez, and he's 77 and almost no difference. And
you can't hear anything.
And he plays. And it wasn't totally the hits. He played a lot of stuff from 1995 onward in that show. And maybe even the highlight was The Ghost of Tom Joad. It was pretty incredible. So he's out there doing a new thing as well. Anyway, it's interesting, this problem of older artists going out. I also saw Leonard Cohen when he was past 80, did a great show. Not only great, but 3 hours.
Yeah, it was long. Yeah.
It was amazing.
He got down on his knees and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly, you know, I mean, I don't know how old Muddy Waters was, but I was at the last waltz and Dylan was there and Muddy Waters was there, and Muddy Waters was great that night, just as great as anybody. Yeah. You know, so a lot of those blues guys, they played until the end.
Yeah, you don't think about how old they are when you're watching them. I've seen I saw Albert Collins and Buddy Guy and lots of guys. And I wasn't wondering like, oh, is he 68 or what? You know, I don't know.
A couple of years ago, I saw a guy performing at the Levi Stadium where the 49ers play. And this guy was running up and down the stage, and he's the same age as Joe Biden. His name is Mick Jagger. And I was thinking, wow, that's something. I mean, the fact that those guys are not only still alive, but they're just incredible. The Rolling Stones are just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And they pop up in your book, too. But the rivalry between, I mean, I think that's kind of an obvious one, the Stones and the Beatles, whereas the Dylan and the Beatles is more surprising.
Yeah, it was, the thing that surprised me was that in the coverage, in things that really the best critics wrote in the 60s that are now forgotten, like Ralph J. Gleason in California and Robert Christgau, they would often compare Dylan and the Beatles to each other. Not so much the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. That seemed to be like not that interesting to them. And writing even at the time that they were replying to each other in songs. And I think that kind of got forgotten because the Beatles Stones hype was, you know, that's a good story, these two rival bands. I don't think the rivalry was as fierce. They were pretty friendly for the most part. And also, I don't think the Beatles felt scared in that way of the Stones like they did of Dylan. They felt challenged. You know, when they're sitting there listening to Highway 61 Revisited in a hotel room, and at the time, the longest song they've put out is Ticket to Ride, which was like 3 minutes and 13 seconds or something. Yeah. There's not one song on Highway 61 Revisited that's, I think, under 5 minutes even. Oh, wow. And they're like, what's going on here? And it ends with Desolation Row, and they're sitting there, you know, listening to this. And I'm sure they feel like, oh, you know, what have we got to do to top that? You know, they didn't have the same kind of worry about the Rolling Stones. And I mean, I don't know how you feel, but I mean, I love the 60s Stones, but I feel like it's really the very late 60s and the 70s Stones that to me like really break through to something else that I really like even more than the 60s stuff. So they might have hit their stride a little later too.
Well, I you know, and they stayed together, which is the phenomenon of all time.
Yeah.
But the breadth of the Stones is not nearly the same as with the Beatles. I mean, the Stones are basically a blues band that play several versions of I Can't Get No Satisfaction in various ways. Whereas, you know, you have Your Blues and Eleanor Rigby and, you know,
yeah.
I Don't Know a Secret. I mean, there's the Beatles played in almost every style.
Yep.
In that way, they're like Bing Crosby. Bing, you know, recorded Hawaiian music, jazz music, recorded in French. He's jazz, pop, whatever. And I think the Beatles were influenced by Bing Crosby, too, because they talk about Please, Please Me being like
that's right.
Crosby's song, Please.
Yep. I think that's right. Yeah.
I think
Dylan loves him, too. Yeah.
Dylan wrote a song that is in the exact tune of Bing Crosby's theme song, right? Bing Crosby's theme song is Where the Blue of the Night Meets the Gold of the Day. And Dylan wrote a song to that tune, that song called When Your Deal Goes Down, which is the same song. Even the bridge is the same.
And that song, as Ringo singled out as his favorite, one of his favorite Dylan songs, which show that Ringo kept up. He's not just a fan of the old stuff. So. Yeah.
Ringo has a new album that's pretty great. It's amazing that of this solo career, Ringo was the first to really nail it, put out a solo record that was solid all the way through, was a crowd pleaser. And the Beatles are all contributors on that record.
Yeah. And he had so many big hits. I mean, one after another in that early 70s period. And they were enjoyable, big fat pop tunes. So,
And he's older than Paul, and he's still out there performing, too. I think that on the new McCartney album, which while we're recording this, I haven't heard the album yet, but they have a duet on the record, Ringo and Paul. I'm anxious to hear it.
Yeah, I haven't heard it quite yet. Yeah, either. But
talk a little bit about the Traveling Wilburys. The merging of the Beatles and Dylan.
You know, I think this is, I think it was a good thing for Dylan. He's kind of at a low point in his career there in the mid 80s. Not only were his albums not selling, but he felt kind of unsatisfied. I think George was kind of returning a favor to him when he kind of brought him into the Traveling Wilburys very gently, you know. In 68, they had written songs together, and that made George feel newly confident. Right after doing that with Dylan in 68, he completed the writing of Something, which was he was having trouble with. And his wife, Patty, said that that made him feel, you know, made him feel great after he'd felt disrespected by Lennon and McCartney. He also wrote All Things Must Pass there in Bearsville, New York in 68 during that trip. So then 20 years later, Dylan's at a low point and George kind of whispers him into the Traveling Wilburys, and they record that first track in Dylan's garage studio in Malibu. And I think it relaxed Dylan. You know, he had a little fancier setup than he had in Bearsville, but playing music in the same way he did with the band in 67 when they were doing the basement tape stuff, and also in the same general easier style. You know, he wasn't straining to make some important statement, and as a result, I think wrote some great songs with, you know, in collaboration with the other Wilburys, and they put him back in the pop charts, you know, and that definitely helped out. And it was a time when he decided to, once the Wilburys were done, that's when he breaks off on his own, no longer going on tour with Tom Petty and the Grateful Dead, but starting that never ending tour, just himself with a trio, and just come what may, even if he has to play small theaters and that kind of thing. And that's where he really turns his career around. I mean, I think, I don't know if we'd have the Nobel Prize winning Dylan if he hadn't made that move and then eventually made, you know, Oh Mercy and Time Out of Mind, which are great late career albums that kind of thing you have to make to stay kind of in that kind of conversation.
Yeah, I mean, most artists of this era that we're talking about have an upward trajectory in their 20s. That's when they do their best work, and then they either don't work at all, or they died when they were 27, or they, you know, do some stuff and then they fade away. But Paul Simon, Lennon and McCartney, Lennon didn't live very long, but, and Dylan, they all had this period where they remade themselves and had late career. I mean, I don't know what would have happened if John had lived, but he did have a big hit there with Woman and Watching the Wheels. And Paul Simon had Graceland, which was bigger than anything he had done with Simon and Garfunkel or solo. And Paul continuously has moments where, you know, I think that like Flowers in the Dirt and then Flaming Pie, where people go, oh, let's Chaos and Creation in the Backyard. Let's pay attention to what Paul's doing because it's really good.
Yep. And even those 90s albums he put out as the Fireman DJ Youth, which I think are great. And and pushing himself in that kind of in that way. And yeah, they have great second acts. I think Lennon would have had a great second act. George kind of was done after the second Wilburys album. He just withdrew from public life. It's funny that he had this great comeback in the late 80s, you know, a number one album and single, and then the Wilburys on top of that, another Wilburys album. And then I think he was just done. You know, he didn't really like, he did like the applause, but not the bother that went with it. So, and he did record a lot at home. I mean, there's a posthumous album, Brainwashed, which is very, it's good all the way through. There's nothing wrong with it. You know, it's a good record, but he just wasn't interested in pushing himself in that way anymore.
No, he lost his ambition, which was very fierce when he first went solo. I mean, I can imagine, you know, can you, you know, this on the Beatles Anthology 3, there's a lovely version of All Things Must Pass, a Beatles version of All Things Must Pass. And you're thinking the Beatles say, well, you know, we like this song, but we have to put Maxwell's Silver Hammer on and we don't have room for All Things Must Pass. I mean, that must have burned.
Yeah. It's also weird that McCartney said a couple years ago that his top three albums, and he named Music from Big Pink as one of them. And All Things Must Pass sounds like, you know, it could fit on Music from Big Pink. It's written in that, you know, I think it sounds a lot like I Shall Be Released, you know, which is, you know, Dylan's song. I think McCartney was unsatisfied with it from the accounts of those sessions. And sometimes I listen to that version and sometimes it works for me. And sometimes I wonder if like, it's a little plodding. Like I like the version that George came up with afterward more, and maybe McCartney didn't know what to do with it. And maybe he should have left it to George to arrange instead of, assuming that he was the one who was going to do the arrangement for it anyway. Yeah. But, it just didn't quite get there with the Beatles.
I always thought the Beatles were super funny, and I still do. I think they're funny. But I didn't realize until I saw Markham and Wise, the British comedy duo. I didn't see them when I was a kid, but now I have collected all of their programs. And I see that John Lennon is imitating Markham. That's where he gets his style, his comedic style from that comedy team. I think they were a very big influence.
Oh, that's great. As well as the Goons, you think the same kind of thing,
I think more Markham and Wise, because when you listen to Markham, it's almost like John is doing the talking. And then there's an episode where the Beatles are on the show, and they perform together. They get into these crazy outfits and sing. I just think they're a huge influence on them.
That's cool. I'll listen more to that. I've seen that one clip of them on that show, but I haven't gone into their Markham and Wise stuff deeply.
You should. Their series that was called Two of a Kind is kind of a Hard Day's Night-ish. But anyway, your book, it's a fabulous book. It is called Where the Music Had to Go, How Bob Dylan and the Beatles Changed Each Other and the World. And we've just scratched the surface of it. Jim Wendolph, it's a fabulous book. Congratulations on all its success. And thank you so much for making some time here on From the Bookshelf. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Gary. I hate to leave. It was fun. Thanks a lot for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.